Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Evie Cafe Takeaway, where you find us mid-amusement. We've decided to just kind of start recording because actually it's just too good. And what is specifically too good is that we have got one of our very first podcast people. I think number one from memory, and it is the number one himself, Graham Cooper.
Thank you. So when you say the number one, yes, or does that mean I was just the guinea pig, the experiment? I mean, yes. I know I was the first
yes,
one.
Yes, I mean, that's...
You know.
Old lab rat himself.
Absolutely.
I think that's harsh on his goatee.
Yeah, maybe. No, it's just, no, I'm just tight. I just can't afford the Gillettes, right? I mean, sorry, other razor blades are available. No, this is winter mode. I'm, you know, it's minus... six right now here in Massachusetts. But no, you guys have been on a huge journey. I mean, if you think about, I mean, how many episodes have you now done? I mean,
150 something. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so I've kept pace. I reckon I've kept pace with about 50% of those. So apologies for not staying on top of all of them. But you've had some amazing conversations, though.
Mm. We've been blessed. You set us up well.
Yes.
Or I was just a lab rat and you corrected afterwards. Yeah. That's fine.
Well, you did set the bar very high for us and of course I think kind of gave us that sort of doorway into the industry because people took us seriously sort of right off the bat.
Oh, fooled them. No, I think do you know what I reflect on? I kind of, I guess, what this platform actually allows you to do is to have a human conversation. Often you find in a disruptive market, right, and we are still in a disruptive market, everybody has to feel like they're on corporate message. Everybody has to feel like they're under scrutiny and have approval. And I think if you recognize that podcasting actually is a lovely vehicle just to have a conversation and to be human, right? We'll deal with the litigation afterwards. But no, I think it's important that we do have to have those rich conversations that are not processed, over-processed, over-synthesized. You know, just be human. And I think this is a lovely platform for that.
It really is. And Graham, we need to address the elephant in the room. Because you've said minus six, we don't very often get that here in the UK. Because a few things have changed since we spoke. You were National Grid. You were.
I was transitioning at the point at which we had the last conversation.
That's true.
We're not falling for that. Not happening. No,
not getting drawn in.
Not even going there. No going there. But no, seriously. Yeah, yeah. So tell us, you're right. So I'm in Boston, Massachusetts right now. This is home. So when we last spoke, I was in the process of departing National Grid and getting my visa and coming to the US. I've now been here 2.5 years. I'm a green card holder, so I'm technically a permanent resident, so I can stay forever if I want to. We'll come back to that later. I've now had a couple of jobs here just by the nature of the change of the market. And yeah, I've now bought a house and bought an EV and trying to make the house that I'm in as eco-friendly as my house in the UK. So yeah, it's minus six right now. And in the past week, we've had minus 27 with wind chill. So there's two feet of snow. We've had 27 inches of snow here. There's still about 2 feet outside.
Wow.
Graham, talk to us about life in the States, because a lot of us are sitting outside of your bubble saying, what on earth is going on, quite literally, in the United States? We have ICE agents wandering the streets, just dragging around anybody who doesn't appear like you and I. And it is quite scary sometimes, I think, to look in to America as the bastion of society and say that's as good as we can be, especially mindful of the fact that the wonderful President Trump yesterday tore up the rule book when it comes to emissions and our movement towards net zero. Can you give us just a sense of what life is really like for you in America?
So do you know, it's almost the most thing I most often ask you. When someone hears my accent, they say, you're here, why? You've got a British passport. Why are you not on the next plane out of Dodge, right? I mean, that is a genuine question. I'll tell you how best I answer it, right? I live in Massachusetts, which is the bluest state of the... it's only ever been blue. Some states have swung from blue to red, some are purple states. This is a blue state. It only ever been a blue state. And funnily enough, 250 years ago, America's independence started in the next town. Okay.
Indeed.
So we're celebrating 250 years of beating up the Brits from the US perspective. But my response is America is globally so big, so powerful, and has such a huge impact that I would argue that I'm as much impacted in Massachusetts by anything Mr. Trump says and does as you are in the UK. And so, you know, it's a difficult one. I think it's a case of where would I rather be, here or there? Under this administration, I don't really know. I'm not sure there's actually a straight answer. How do I describe sort of, I guess, the sort of the sentiment? There is genuinely an element of, oh my God, how do we find ourselves here? There is certainly an element of voter regret. I guess it's difficult because don't forget, as a green card holder, I can be here, but I can't vote. So arguably, can I have a political opinion? Well, I can't exercise that opinion. So I'm just a passenger in a process, arguably just as much as you are. But there is the best way to describe it, I think everyone's wandering around holding their breath, like the what next? If I'm trying to be a bit more statesmanlike about this, what America has done over a lot of its history is realize it was the big dog, right? It's been the daddy, right, on geopolitics, by size of its economy, the dollar. And for most of that, it's behaved very statesmanlike, statesperson-like, and realized that diplomacy has a way and a process of gently getting us to a better place. And to some extent, what we've got now is somebody sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater and let's just see what lands. And I think a lot of that distrust, a lot of that concern, risk, what have you, is translated into, I guess, trust and confidence is evaporated all over the place. And that turns up in weird ways. And as you and I go, you and I know, one of my favorite things is looking at the risk of unintended consequences. The risk of unintended consequences are huge. And I think it's going to take a decade to actually work out really, truly, what those true unintended consequences will be.
If you operate a fleet of cars or vans, you'll know electric is the future. Transitioning to EVs can appear daunting, but with Europe Car, it's effortless. Our long-term EV rentals eliminate the upfront costs, contract commitments, and uncertainty. Instead, you'll get total flexibility, a wide choice of cars and vans, and Europe Car's expert support. So, make the switch without the stress and experience Europe Karma. Search Europe Car Business.
But that's a real problem because we don't have a decade.
And we do not.
What fascinates me is that you say that, you know, what happens in America doesn't affect what's going on in Europe. And I wonder, because business almost needs permission to be what it needs to be. Donald Trump is giving European businesses permission, if they choose, to throw away the rule book and to say net zero doesn't matter, emissions, do what you like. It's all about business. Commerce. The capitalist society is busy here destroying our homes and we're voting for it. It's madness. Yet we all kind of just collectively go, okay. Even in Minnesota, where they've pushed back hard against ICE agents, they've kind of reached a collaboration, or reached an understanding and gone, Okay, we'll give you a few people, you get your ICE agents out, and we'll just carry on as though nothing happened. Yet basic fundamental human rights are being undermined. And we see that, and we see a similar approach to our own immigrants in the UK because Donald Trump has allowed and enabled that to happen with what he does and says.
Yeah. So, well, firstly, I didn't say I wasn't impacted. I'm just saying in Massachusetts, I'm as impacted as you are in the UK. So America impacts everywhere globally. So it's not not impact. So sorry to correct you, John, but
no,
I just want to make
right.
sure we're being really appropriate here. So yeah, I mean, look, this is a really difficult one. I think, can I segue slightly to I just help you sort of pivot? Because it's funny, having been on the outside looking at the US and now being on the inside looking out, you realize that there are some strange sort of constructs here. So don't forget, in the UK, we have a very, very strong government that sets all of the rules. And then local government is arguably reasonably weak. You know, it worries about emptying the bins and filling potholes or not filling potholes, right? Don't forget, the best way to... But when you look at the US, arguably, federal government is not as strong, relatively. I mean, arguably, it is the global citizen and it holds the money. But what you've got is you've got 50 states, and the 50 states operate like countries. They have their own tax regime. They have their own. I mean, I learned this. I mean, weirdly, I've been here 2.5 years. I've learned that Arizona chooses not to have a summertime and a wintertime clock. It's the only state in the US that doesn't move. Everyone else moves, and they don't all move at the same time. Go figure. So literally, when people look at the states, what you need to understand is, actually, the best way to describe it is the US and its 50 states actually looks and functions more like Europe than you'd realize. But the only difference is what you see is that trickle down from money and rules from federal to state. The state is only able to operate because it gets a share of the purse from federal. So if you can control the money, you control commerce. If you can control commerce, you control the rules. If you control the rules, you control the narrative. And so what you find is you've got that strange thing happening, which is federal has a responsibility for the US, so we're going to push in National Guard or ICE agents to go fix stuff because we don't think you can do it. The state has almost no ability to say stop because there are country rules versus federal rules, federal rules versus state rules, and the state legislatures are busy running around trying to put in new rules in the state to limit the impact of federal. So the nearest analogy, I don't think there's a real direct analogy, but it's a little bit like, Europe and the construct of Europe and all of the European states. They will operate autonomously, but they have a sort of a shared mentality and rule book. I also don't want people to confuse the difference between, you know, that federal and state in normal operation historically and federal and state as is operating now, right? You know, at the moment, it feels a little bit like bandit country. But at the end of the day, a process is run. The American people have voted, whether they still agree that that was the thing and they don't have voter regret. But, they have voted, a process is run. There's an element here that people say, well, a process is run and we have to wait for the next step of the process to see what happens next. So, I mean, it's, you know, the trouble is what do you do? What do you do? I mean, you could take this to a full projection, John, and say, right, well, everyone should just bear arms and rebel, right? Sedition is the answer, right? You end up in anarchy, right? So I think to some extent, what you've got is grown up responsible people who generally follow all the rules have said a process has run and this is what we ended up with. And we just have to let the process run until something else turns up.
I'm with Rosa Parks.
let me bring one thing though, is often people think that the sort of the craziness that what we're in now is a 4-year process, except it isn't. And again, you know, I kind of thought, well, you elect a president, they do what they want to do for 4 years, and then you elect another one, right? No. So what you've got is the US government and the Senate is now all red, right? Which means they can do kind of what the hell they like without too many checks and balances. However, we're closing in on the midterms, right? Now, the midterms is that acid test. It's the barometer on your president and your party and how it's doing. Okay, so to some extent, what you get to is the first year and a bit of a presidency is kind of free reign for the president. Then you've got the half an eye to the midterms, because if you need to course correct, you've got a little bit of a window of opportunity to kind of course correct before the midterms. But if you get to the midterms and you have your ass handed to you on a plate, ooh, you need to work very, very hard on positioning over the next 2 years to stand a chance of your party being re-elected. So I would, I think we're all sort of sitting in somewhat disbelief of how the hell did we get here and what next? But I would also say, I think that starts to dampen sort of from here forward. I mean, I don't think it's a sudden change, but I think you'll start to see a calming. I think you have to. But I also see red voters just thinking about this gives us a bit of a new world order, right? You know, because America was the big boy in town. I mean, I'm sounding a little Trumpian right now, but you know, America was the big boy in town, so it shouldered a lot of the burden of NATO. And actually what you found is, I said, yes, other countries have sort of said, well, hang on, if they're picking up the check, well, let them pick up the check. It helps my economy. So I think what we've found is once we get through this disruption crazy, I think Mark Carney sort of expressed it really, really well. There is a new world order, and, you know, things will settle into a new world order. I just hope they settle into calm and diplomacy, because we need to be grown-ups.
Oh, it's like being on the BBC. It's just great, isn't it? Isn't he fabulous? It's like being tuned into Fox News.
Actually, you know what we do here? We toggle. So you can watch CNN and they say, well, this is really terrible. And we've, you know, and the same news article on Fox is, yay, we're going to burn stuff. You know, and you're like, different sides of the same coin. So the advice given to me when Mr. Trump got in is just stop watching the news. Because you'd end up doom scrolling. And actually, it's a real thing. I find myself getting I end up switching off from news, because you just kind of go, this doesn't make me feel well.
No, indeed. And I mean, you mentioned bearing arms. I think for us outsiders looking in, we figured that America started bearing arms some years ago, long before Trump got in, and have been doing that ever since. But I think it's very real to like, you know, almost like watch in on the goldfish bowl. And we're that podcast focused on the zero emission future that we all hope for. That's the old start. But is it gone? I mean, has the zero emission future for America disappeared? Because, I mean, you know, we're holding on to it here in the UK for dear life. 2035, ban on sale of petrol and diesel vehicles, all zero emission from therefore going forward. Obviously, there's no such thing in America.
This is where it gets really interesting. You know, so one of the reasons for the drivers of me getting to the US was I thought, if I could even be as 1% successful in the US as I was in the UK, then I can abate more emissions, right? So the driver here is, go to a dirtier country, even if you're less effective, you still have a greater, you know, global climate impact. So that's the driver for me being here. But this is where it gets really interesting. So from a US perspective, they set those big ground rules. So like, you know, the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, those set big, you know, national standards. But every state can have its own. So Massachusetts still has a zero emission mandate. It still has effectively a percentage by targets. Many of the states do. So this is one of those things which is, headline says net zero's gone because Trump says it is. More than half the states still have, you know, heat pump mandates, you know, EV mandates and what have you. My EV, I've got a Kia EV9, right? My Kia EV9 is not a Korean vehicle. It's made in Cincinnati, Ohio, right? So it's an American product made in America for an American market, right? So when Mr. Trump says made in America, my EV is quite a lot American, right? But there's something that you're starting to see now that is actually really. I mean, I don't know. Do you follow Jim Farley, the boss of Ford? So bearing in mind, you couldn't get more American and homegrown and your motherhood and apple pie than Ford, right? It's the bedrock of Motor City, you know, Detroit. It's, you know, big iron. It's the Rust Belt. It's the you know, what built America, right? I mean, if that and Jeep, right? So anyway, Jim Farley has been very, very open, which is electrification is inevitable. And just the messing around with what we're doing now doesn't help anyone. So, you know, even I think in the last 24, 48 hours, he's been talking about their new platform, how they're driving efficiency first in EVs. The next Ford F-150 Lightning, the electric pickup, they've realized for those who do heavy loads and long distances, electrification solely isn't the answer. So it's just going to be added with a range extender. Now, there are some people saying, well, it's now a gas car. No, it's 90% electric. But for those extreme use cases, it now fits those extreme use cases, right? So I think that there are a couple of things that I think you're going to see. Actually, let's do a couple of things. I had a quick look at percentage numbers. I know, obviously, with the ZEV mandate, you've got percentage of sales. So 2021, 3% of all new car sales were EVs. 2022, 5%. 2023, 6.3%. 2024, 7.6%. Last year, so 2025, we don't have all the full results. But there was, you know, it was a drop because of the loss of the mandate. But the trajectory broadly, if you smooth out, you know, policy change, the long direction of travel, is there are quite a lot of EVs sold here. And because it's a big country with a lot of vehicles, you might say, well, it's 7.6% of EVs sold. Hang on, what does that equate to? That's 1.2 million EVs.
Oh, wow.
Okay, right. So if you want to do actual numbers, there are a lot of EVs sold here. Against the backdrop, as a percentage, not quite so much. It's also different by state. Again, because states drive the rules rather than federal. Federal impacts the rules, states drive the rules. It's different by state. So I'm watching a couple of things. Mark Carney has said in Canada, I'm going to allow Chinese EVs in. We're going to have BYDs and all this sort of stuff coming in. We don't see any of that in the US. But if you bring it into Canada, register it, use it, and then sell it to an American as a secondhand car, I think there could be quite a healthy secondhand Chinese car market coming over the border. I simply don't know. So what weirdly is being set up now is, if from a federal perspective you put the blinkers on, you say climate change doesn't happen, climate change is solved because we've done away with the legislation that everything's based on. Climate change is fixed. Donald Trump should have a Nobel Peace Prize. Got to be careful here. I might lose my green card. But when you think about the impact though, America is trying to make cars for Americans, and it's trying to make cars and export to the rest of the world. But if it keeps making bigger and bigger, less environmentally appropriate cars, you instantly starve the export. You know, the market, the export market is gone. Hang on. Foreign direct investment is pretty important, right, when you're running a country. And then you start to think about so what if Americans want to buy something exotic from Europe? Yes, but all they can buy is energy efficient EVs. Are they going to buy them if the sentiment is, that doesn't matter anymore? So all of a sudden, stuff you want to buy probably won't be available. So who does that hurt most? This feels like America hurting America. Because if the rest of the world, if electrification is inevitable, if you subscribe to that, and many would, it's a function of time. But if you largely assume that much more efficient, less to go wrong, you could do a lot of recycling, you know, vehicle to grid, all the things we know and love. So if electrification is arguably sort of inevitable, all that's happening right now is self-harm.
That's a really good point.
And this is where it comes to those risks of unintended consequences. If you're in the White House and you say, right, we're going to tear up the fundamental construct, right, of climate change, because we don't like the start-stop button. You know, when you pull up at the lights, the combustion engine pauses. Trump said in his run-up to the election is, I'm going to fix that. Promise made, promise delivered. And you're like, right, okay, so we're removing the construct for everything that goes out of the emissions of a power station or a vehicle. Even efficiency standards of your washer, your dryer, your heat pump has been thrown out of the window. did you really think that through? What are those risks of unintended consequences? So this is where I come back to the point, which is, I think it's going to take a little while. I said, you know, it's going to take 10 years for us to really realize what the unintended consequences of what's happened. However, I'd love to introduce a term to you fine gentlemen, because I'd love for us to use it more widely, because I see it. So, you know, previously when somebody said, "Way, I built a solar farm, big ribbon cutting, you know, this is going to avoid this many emissions." We now have a thing here called green hushing. People are still building wind farms and solar plants. They're still doing all that eco stuff, but they're just being silent about it because in most cases, electrification, clean energy is lowering the cost. It's adding energy independence. It's energy security, often in the US supplied by something made in America, right? So what I'm seeing is, I suspect, even in this regime, the biggest form of generation added is going to be renewables in some form. I mean, you're going to see an uptick in gas for fast-moving data centers. We're seeing a lot of that. But still, there are a lot of renewable projects in stream that are going to get delivered. It's just that no one's talking about them. So my term for you, if you take away nothing from this podcast, is try and use the term green hushing. We're all just quietly getting on with it, just not making a big fanfare.
It's funny because a friend of mine here in Bedford actually has got a wind farm business. When I say wind farm business, he does the all the clever geology stuff, saying how far he does a lot of offshore stuff like that, and had a lot of projects in America. And of course, when Trump got in, they stopped in a heartbeat. I mean, everything just went off a cliff. And about 6 weeks ago, he just started getting more business again. And it's just gone, like, up. And I guess it's quite possible. It didn't happen at all.
Remember the term green hushing? Yes. Quietly getting on with it. But go on.
But quietly getting on with it. And it's... It is that is going to be the one of the key drivers, isn't it? The cost of this is coming down. And actually, Americans hit by inflation, us all around the world, right? We're all hit by rising costs. Well, if something's going to be cheaper and it's going to be nicer, and let's face it, 90% of people would agree, you know, that getting into an electric vehicle is a much nicer thing to do. They're all used to automatics in America. It's all a really good thing. It's just the classic case of getting more bums on seats and helping people understand that actually it's going to save them hard cash, isn't it?
Well, you see, this is where it gets really interesting, Paul. If I look this way, I can see my neighbor's roof, and he's just had an entire roof of solar panels put on. American-made panels, American-made inverter, American-fitted. It's going to take, even though the cost of energy here is a little cheaper, the payback on that, he tells me, is 8.5 years, because he's buying American panels, because you can't buy Chinese panels. Whereas in the UK, high energy price, cheap panels, if you put solar on your roof, the payback's about 2 years, 3 months right now in the UK on a solar. I mean, you know, a fence panel's arguably the same price as a solar panel. Not here, it's not. And so you, here, we're still very reliant on subsidy. You know, my neighbour is, even to get that 7.5 year payback, he has claimed his subsidy for that. And so I think it's one of those things. Yes, the tech is better, but also the construct is different. I mean, let's pick EVs, for example. There's almost no company car vehicles in America. I mean, white panel vans, right? You know, your HVAC fitter, or your, you know, there are a lot of panel van fleets, and they're company owned. But pretty much every vehicle, every car, every light vehicle is privately owned. So you are not driving on targets. You're driving with wallets, and it's wallets and product. So the nice, I mean, if you again, standing here looking back at your market, because about 51% of all new car sales in the UK are bought by a company, whether that's a finance company for lease or their company cars, the policy and mandate means more of those are going electric at pace, which then creates you a very, very healthy secondhand market, okay? So the rate of pace of change is driven by actually the construct of the market. Here, we've got a different problem. people buy a car and drive it till the wheels fall off. And then the equivalent of the MOT is not that stringent. So there is wheels falling off. And so what you hear is a very different mentality. So if I rock up in an EV, I'm how virtue signaling my voting intent, right? I'm doing something economically illogical. Because arguably, the cost of electricity versus the cost of gas, petrol, you don't do an EV here to save any money. You do it because it's the right, better thing to do. And so, again, it's one of those really different ones. So if you think about it, you've got to realize that the market construct, those principal drivers are fundamentally different. But of course, America still recognizes that everybody has a right to bear arms, and everybody has a right to freedom of speech, and everybody has a right to the vehicle they drive. And if you follow the current administration, no one's going to tell you anything. You do what you want to do. Whereas in Europe, we have a sort of, you know, rules base. We have an objective you want to get to. So you put legislation and rules that arguably nudge you towards that. So here, the sort of course correction is, what does states do to incentivize, because they want cleaner air and more efficiency and what have you. But also, what's the narrative to the public? And so here they work very, very hard that EVs are quick and they're quiet. And because they don't have big transmission tunnels and big engines, look at all the storage and cup holders you could have, right? It's a very, very different construct, a very different sales process. I'd also add another fundamental difference is, having been an EV driver in 2017 in the UK, public charging here is circa 2015 UK standard, right? So, you know, I chose a Kia EV9 because here it comes with a Tesla NACS socket. Because you kind of go, biggest charging network I can see is Tesla. Although I can only access whatever it is, 40% of them. But that's the base level. Whereas in the UK, there's lots of charging networks and lots of drivers in that, and Tesla is just in the crowd. Here, if you don't have a NACS socket, it's a little dicey. But at the same time, there is big drivers by states and utilities to put in the grid capacity to do rapid chargers. We get 350 kilowatt rapid chargers here, but we might only just get two together and you end up with a bit of waiting. But, you know, this is why everything's the same here, that everything's different.
I want to pick up on that, because as I was listening to you speak, the man I know comes out, the leader, the person who sets the bar and says, this is what is the right thing to do. And I wonder, Graham, how you maybe have had to metamorphosize, be a chameleon, change slightly to deal with your different market, because as you say, green hushing is now the way forward rather than being that leader that everybody sees and says he's right, you know. How have you had to change?
Hugely. How would I best describe it? So I've always been, even though I am a driver for clean electrons completely across climate change and the drivers for it and the need to do action, I am also a pragmatist and a realist that you need to bring the majority with you. And arguably, you need to see a route for profitability because it's money that drives everything. So pragmatist and realist, right? So I have had to find a new comfort around pragmatism and realism. I'll give you two almost extreme examples, just to kind of really set that. This week, I am talking, you know, the organization I currently work for, I've been helping a 3 gigawatt data center, or it planned to be a 3 gigawatt data center. So that's like the capacity of Reading or Leeds, one box full of computer stuff, right? They're down the route of, yeah, you know, within the next 5 years, we're going to be 3 gigawatts and we're going to be largely nuclear driven, right? SMRs. And you kind of go, that's great. But right now, SMRs are not licensed to operate. They're going through that process. They're not necessarily insurable.
Please, sir, SMR? What's an SMR?
Small modular reactor. Google Rolls-Royce SMR. Small modular reactor. So small nuclear. Except when you look at them, they're not that small and they're not that modular. But we'll get don't let the facts get in the way of a good story.
No, exactly.
Right? But anyway, smaller than a mega, you know, power station. Let's do sizes. So a typical nuclear power station is in the gigawatts. A small modular reactor is going to be 350, 450 megawatts. And then you get micro nuclear, which is going to be 20 to 30 megawatts, you know, like a reactor in a shipping container kind of mentality, right?
Essentially, now, it's me, you and Paul, you know, all lined up together.
Yeah, yeah. I get that.
Massive, medium and kind of, you know, itty bitty.
I'm not even going to dive on in with that because I feel a lawsuit coming on.
Well done, well done, Graham. Very wise.
But coming back to the point though is the ambition is 3 gigawatts, and you go, that's a really big number. So, you know, just don't forget the UK right now, normal operating, you know, I guess you're probably running right now, and you could probably Google it. You're probably at about between 30 and 40 gigawatts. So just one data center, 3 gigawatts, right? So just for context, so. How do they get to 3 gigawatts? Well, they need to do minimum viable product. What do they get going? So they're saying to me, we need between 200 and 300 megawatts of gas reciprocating engines because we can't wait for the grid. So they said, we've got a gas pipe running through our, you know, whatever it is, 1700 acres. And we are just going to put gas powered engines in. So this is just like, you know, train engines, you know, ship engines, gas reciprocating engines, you know, pistons up and down. 200 to 300 megawatts. Right, that's like Heathrow Airport car parks with every parking space with a generator in it. So you kind of go, well, hang on, I'm in that spot which is plug it into the grid, make the grid cleaner. And if you can't plug it into the grid, do it with renewables. And they said, well, then that 17,000 acres, we don't have enough room for enough renewables for the reliability we need. So you're into that spot which is, okay, well, at least gas is cleaner than oil and diesel and petrol, right? So it's cleaner, not cleanest. But they are then into the spot, which is if you do the first 200 or 300 megawatts with a reciprocating engine, and then that gets you to nuclear, which is clean at use. Okay, I sort of see a stepping stone from here to there. So that pragmatism and realism is a daily battleground for me. But at the same time, I am delighted by things at the other end of the scale. I can't name the city because of NDAs and stuff, but there is a very, very major city in the US that has that set itself a mandate and has held to that, which is they will not have combustion vehicles by 2035. And you kind of go, well, it's a lofty ambition. What does that look like? That's 10,000 vehicles with an engine. 10,000 vehicle fleet to go electric by 2035. My team are delivering the assessment, the EV transition plan, and advising them on when and where to go with that. And that is everything, guys, from a chainsaw and a push mower right the way through to fire trucks. Now, you kind of go, well, I can see a route to an electric mower today. I'm not sure there's a healthy market in electric fire trucks. So, you know, a lot of this is about stick with the ambition, stick with the vision, but then a pragmatic way to deliver that. So I come back to that. It's pragmatism and realism. And I think you catch more of the people more of the time when you are a little less evangelical.
Yeah,
like it.
And I've had to learn to bite my tongue a lot, but also realize that I have to operate in a slightly different way here.
So Graham, you've had to move lock, stock and 2 smoking barrels to America. You've obviously made some changes. You've had to adapt yourself. The actual move itself for me feels challenging. You know, it's like one of those things that you sort of think, oh gosh, I'm going to leave all my friends and family behind. And I know that you're, you know, not everything has gone smoothly, has it, since you've arrived in America. A few things changed. Two things. One, what's been the biggest personal challenge whilst you've been in America? And also, what do you miss most about the UK? And how do you compensate for that?
Can I do that in reverse Miss World order? So let's do the last one first.
Anyone you like.
Right, okay. So what do I miss? Yorkshire tea, Marmite, And I miss that America puts sugar in everything, right? So you know, those are the things. But you know, when you fly into the UK, I go straight to Costco. I get the 9,000 bag sack of Yorkshire tea, and I carry it back as hand luggage, right? So I mean, you can buy Yorkshire tea in the US. People import it, but I tend to buy a 9,000 catering sack of Yorkshire tea bags and I carry it. So it's fine. Other things, kettles. Americans don't do kettles. If you want a cup of tea, they put water in a microwave with the bag in. That's not good. There are daft things. Actually, Paul, but more fundamentally, firstly, let's recognise that I am incredibly lucky. Okay, the work that I did in the UK enabled me to get a visa. The visa enabled me to get a green card. I worked for a company that America saw the value in my experience that is progressive and valued in the US. Right. So right place, right time, ton of luck, bit of hard work, but there's a ton of luck in that as well. So I have to recognize that I've just been lucky. My dad, who died 12 years ago, said to me, son, the answer's yes. Then asked, what was the question? Regret the things in life that you did rather than the opportunities you missed. So I was very lucky that I studied part of my MBA in the US and that pricked my interest. My job enabled me to come here. But I would always class myself, Paul, as a home bunny, right? Berkshire born, Berkshire raised. My home is still in the UK, in Berkshire. My family lived there. I would say that that was where I was going to be born, grow up, live and die. And that was home. What the move has enabled me to do is, one, nothing's forever. So you ship everything up and send it halfway around the world. But when you unpack and you sort of bed down, you kind of suddenly realize actually home is just where the heart is. Wife and kids and animals here. This is home, right? But also nothing's forever. So, you know, I could arguably put this house on the market today. I could pack up a suitcase, I could go to the airport, buy a ticket, fly home. I mean, the people who are renting my house, I'd have to ask them to politely leave, but I could, to some extent, switch back to what I had in 48 hours. I mean, there'll be some hangover to that. So I think my perspective has changed incredibly. I think much more globally now. I think about the differences as much as the similarities. Just because something works in one jurisdiction and arguably you think it should work here, they need to find their own way. But I also think it challenges you. I mean, I have loved this. It's been a rocky road. There's been some highs and some lows. But I wouldn't change it for a heartbeat. And so it's I guess, you know, look, life's a, there's not, you just got to live it, right? You got one go. And so I'm just living it and grabbing hold of it with both hands and just trying to make the most of it. But also it's quite handy. If I got on a plane now, wheels up to wheels down, so Boston to the UK is 5 hours and 23 minutes from wheels up to wheels down.
Wow.
Right. So how long would it take you to get in the car and drive to Aberdeen?
Yeah.
I mean, my daughter.
2 hours for him.
Yeah, if you fly. My daughter is at Royal Holloway. She's studying zoology at Royal Holloway, which is relatively close to Heathrow Airport. She can finish class, pack a suitcase, get to the airport, and be here for dinner in 8 hours. The world is an incredibly small place now, right? And when you realise that actually I chat to my family as often now as when I was physically in the same, you know, these things are great, right? WhatsApp and Zoom calls and what have you. I speak to my family probably more often now. I'm 3,500 miles away than when I was in the next village. But it's there's a lot of change, but I think you learn a lot about yourself and you also bust your own myths, right? I think Europeans looking at America kind of go, ha ha. I've watched lots and lots of American docu-soaps and dramas and what have you. That's how America functions. No, you get here and you realize that they're just good people trying to live good lives and trying to do the right thing. And people are making the best of the situation they find themselves in. And you suddenly realize, wow, we are truly all the same, just with a different accent.
So very, very wise. You always are, Graham. One of the things you touched on right at the beginning, and it was a kind of hook that we've had to leave, but I'm coming back to it, is you alluded to the fact that there may be change afoot. But you didn't say what that was. You said, I'll park that for a minute. What was the change that you were alluding to in your circumstances?
Oh, no. So I've done, looking back the last 2.5-3 years, I've been through a huge change, but also I'm thinking about what goes forward from here. So those of you who know me will know that obviously when I was last talking to you fine gentlemen, I was in the process of departing National Grid and joining Jacobs to come here on an expat assignment. That was a 2-year, you know, come, land, do something, fly back, right? It was a defined thing. Halfway through that process, a little over halfway through that process, Jacobs sold off their nuclear weapons and defense business to a company called Amentum. And in that dynamic change of their business, they realized that they were sending a lot of people to foreign countries, and an expat assignment is not cheap for a business. So they decided that they would stop a lot of those expat assignments. So halfway through my assignment, I was told, all bets are off, pack up, you've got 3 weeks to come home. Now, that's a little difficult when you've got a son in school doing his final year of his A-levels. That's a little difficult when you've rented out your home in the UK for a 2-year lease, and so there's nowhere to live. And then you ask the business, well, do I still have a job if I move back to the UK? And they go, we'll talk about it when you get back to the UK. That's one of those slightly, it's one of those ocean moments, yeah, when you kind of go, well, now what? But I am incredibly lucky that because I have a green card, again, because of the work that I did with National Grid, because of the work I did in the UK, I wasn't beholden to the sponsorship of that company. And they're still a great company. We are still friends, right? I've not, you know, but I, in the end, I decided not to take their offer to return. So I took a redundancy settlement, right? You know, I'll take my check and walk away. And that's a really hard thing to do, because I was doing it. The easy thing would have been to just go pack up and go, but I would have damaged my son's schooling. I'd have had to rent in the UK. So I had to navigate that. I'm actually choosing to make America a permanent place with no natural route back to the UK. That was hard. That took a lot of soul searching, and that was really, really hard. But when I, 3 weeks into being redundant in the US, you know, I'm very mission driven. I needed to do something. I was lost. You know, you'd kind of go, I'd rearrange the sock drawer, right? I'd swept the garage. You know, I kind of need to be a bit sort of mission driven here, but also I'm going to have some bills to pay in time. So I'm going to have to do something. So a few people had reached out to me and said, well, would you do just a little bit of consulting? I've got no idea how to do freelance. So I set myself up a little business, a little vehicle to do that. And what was going to be a couple of weeks of part-time became 6 months of full-time. So, you know, I did, you know, a ton of work with some really great businesses, some of them startups, some of them scale up, some of them funding. But the cold reality was, in that time, my family said, we might want to stay here a little longer, and I can't keep doing that if I'm earning in pounds and living in dollars. So I needed to get a local job. So, you know, I now work for AECOM, arguably a competitor to Jacobs, but it's a professional services firm, and I run the energy advisory business. I also look after National Grid as a global account, because National Grid are as big here as they are where you are. So those things keep me busy. But I'm now in that space, which is this, I'll do for the next 5 or 6 years, probably. But I'm, what has really excited me is I think I could be more effective being sort of a fractional leader. You know, if I can do some non-exec type work. So what I'm actually looking to do is, you know, sadly, my dad died about 3 weeks before he retired. So my mum still has their retirement wish list on the fridge. That was 12 years ago. I don't want to not have a retirement. So I'm trying to work out now over the next few years, whilst my kids are still at university and I need a day job to pay the, if anybody's had to pay uni fees and cost the kids. Right. So I am stuck in the 9-to-5, at least for now. But, you know, I would love to, in a handful of years times, try to work out how do I do that, you know, fractional sort of job. So that's one thing that sort of, you know, I'm thinking about changing. Right now, it's a solid 9-to-5. There's a lot to do. But also, I'm going to be shortly in that strange period, which is, you gentlemen know that my house in the UK is roughly 600 years old and effectively carbon neutral. So, you know, heat pumps, smart thermostats, EV chargers, process my own wastewater. So the only emission from that house is clean water. Thinking about putting that on the market. Because at the moment, why have a house, family house here and a family house there? So I'm at that very, very difficult spot. And it's not a case of selling up and giving up with the UK. I'm going to sell up, but I'm going to try and find something that's actually arguably more appropriate. You know, it's in Reading or near Reading, Wokingham. So, you know, the reason we were there is because where I was born and raised, it was where I wanted to be for good schools. And it was very handy to get into London. But I don't need the schools. My kids are at university. I don't work in London. And arguably, it would make more sense for me to have something. And so what I really want to do is if I sell that this coming year, what I really want to do is find something rural and make something hyper-sustainable. So, you know, arguably off-grid or net positive. So, you know, I've got to try and work out over the coming years, you know, how do I base my family here for now, but still make sure I've got a home or home in the UK. But it's just, there's a window of opportunity to take what I've learned in a very old listed building and try and apply it to something newer and smarter and, I guess, arguably as progressive as it can be. So yeah, those are the changes that are coming up for me, really.
Very exciting. Yeah,
I'm just reveling in the energy transition. It is just different here. But America's going to spend, I love a throw down number. I don't even know what this looks like if you write it down. Bloomberg recently did a view of how much is America going to have to spend on the energy system in the next 20 years. $3.75 trillion. Just let that sink in for a minute. I don't know what a trillion looks like. What does 3.75 trillion look like? So there's a lot to do in the energy sector. I work in the energy sector. It has never been as wild and crazy and disruptive and opportunistic as it is now. So why am I not going to hold on to that with both hands for the next period of time?
Fantastic. And You touched on it, and you said something just as you were going along, and obviously it has been a real journey. You said you learned stuff about yourself. What have you learned about yourself through this particular experience in your life?
So I think when we spoke before, we talked about resilience, right? Human resilience.
Yeah.
You know, the EV Cafe, as you know, came about as a safe place during COVID. When we were staring into the abyss of COVID, you know, the market was really in its early infancy, and the EV Cafe became the safe place to stay, the place that feels home. And so when we first spoke, I think we talk about that emotional resilience, right?
Yeah.
We don't teach it. And that resilience has to ride you through uncertainty in the employment market, in the economy, in your family life and what have you. So I think one of the things that I've learned a huge amount about myself is I am way more, I thought I was a reasonable, resilient kind of person. I think I found even a new level of resiliency that I didn't know I had. There's that. I also now feel, though, how incredibly small the world is. I'm talking to you fine gentlemen, and I'm 3,260 miles away. I could be in the next room. We could be in the same room. So I think, you know, the combination of technology, the combination of connectivity, you know, we're very, very connected now. Geography doesn't define you. But as I say, it's the emotional resilience bit is the big bit. We need to find a way to be just resilient as humans. We talk about resiliency for grids and resiliency in markets and stuff. Human resiliency is really, really important. Be who you want to be. Know who you are, but also know how you write. You know, the world is not happy, clappy, plain sailing all day long, right? You've got to ride the peaks and the troughs, but you've got to recognize, celebrate the peaks, store them, and remember that when you're in a trough, the only way is up. I mean, I know there are a lot of people we know who've seen redundancy recently and or are facing redundancy coming up. Man, you are staring into that trough. But if you can think about the context, resiliency past the dip, it gives you something positive to focus on, certainly helps with resiliency. So, I think we that's the big learning one for me is I am far more resilient than I thought I was.
That's amazing. And it's funny because I literally got off the phone. There's been something announced today here in the press about you know, potential changes within a manufacturer and all this kind of stuff. And I spoke to somebody in said company that is affected by this kind of news, and we had exactly this conversation, and about the learning of resiliency through life and how we have to take the peaks and then we dip down into the troughs. And we used it just yesterday with somebody else. Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. We're old enough, all of us, to remember.
we remember
this.
Yeah.
We can get knocked about, but we keep coming back up. And for those of you that don't know what a weeble is, Google it, because it'll be cool. But anyway, Graham, listen, we have a closing tradition. I don't know if we fired this closing tradition at you. I'm not sure if we had it by this point.
Not sure.
We have a closing tradition, Graham.
Okay.
And you get to play a part. And that closing tradition is to hand you the EV Cafe magic wand. Here it is. There you go. And it is coming over 3,200 miles all the way to... There you go. He's got it. And it works every time. Even 3,200 miles. Look, there it is. It's even arrived in physical form.
Actually, it's. I don't know whether you can see it. It's a Tesla wand today.
Oh, a Tesla wand. There you go.
Anyway, so go on. Your wand. I've been passed the wand. I am in receipt of the wand.
You have been empowered, and you've been empowered to have one wish. Now you can use this wish in any way you like. I mean, genuinely, we've had from the sublime to the ridiculous. But you go for it. What is your one wish?
Oh, people first. People first. We are impacted by climate change. We're impacted by war. We're impacted by politics. One thing in my travels that I've genuinely learnt is people just want to have a good life. Right? They want a roof over their heads. They want food to eat. They don't want to, right? And everybody has different levels of what that looks like. But the one thing that rides through is I think we just need to look after humans first. And that then allows you to prioritize world peace. I know that sounds very worldly, but it then also allows you to think about climate change, because the human race is going to be very disproportionately impacted by the consequence of what's coming. And I think also, it allows you to have that conversation away from that weaponization of politics, right? That short-termism. Someone has to lose for me to win. So for me, it sounds really worldly and worthy. We need to find a way to be human and look after each other better. And if you start with that as a principle, I think lots of other stuff falls into line, including climate change, world peace, and, diversity and, yeah. So I apologies if that's really wild and very all encompassing, but that's where I'd go.
But you know what? I'm not sure somebody has picked up on such a simple principle, the principle of love your neighbor as you love yourself kind of thing. It is fundamental, right? It's been there since the dawn of time almost, which we've managed to ignore most of the time that time. But John, always such a pleasure to talk with Graham, isn't it?
Never has such a massive brain been put in such a wonderful, wonderful carrier as Graham Cooper.
Oh, can I just tell you, I fooled you.
You have. Hook, line, sinker, my friend. And what the thing that comes out for me is when I see you, all I want to do is give you a massive hug, because you are, quite simply, the most incredibly intelligent, articulate, capable human being. And genuinely, and I say a lot of nice things to people because we're very lucky to talk to great people, but you are singularly the most fabulous person I have ever met in the industry, except you, Paul.
No.
You are. You are. To me. Okay. And the reason that I think that is you make time for people. You know, let's be honest, Paul and I, we do a little podcast and, you know, we get a few hundred people listen to it. And in the scheme of the things that you could be doing right now, it's nothing to do this. But you make the time.
No, I always will. Yep.
It matters. And I love that about you, Graham. Thank you so, so much for being our supporter and our friend. You are without parallel in my world.
Thank you. I'm always happy to help. But I also think
bugger off.
If, Yeah, if everybody just makes a little time for everybody else, the world is a better place, right? So we're on a journey together. But look, thank you. It is delightful as always. And I'm always happy to help. I'm always happy to shoot the breeze, but I'm always happy to be wrong. So, you know, often we put people on pedestals and say, well, this is an expert. Oh, I just know enough to be dangerous, right? So, you know, I'm happy to be wrong. I'm happy to be corrected, but I'm also happy to collaborate to get to a better place.
Do you know what? I'd love to be the person that was clever enough to say, hang on, Graham Cooper, I think you might be wrong. Let's consider this and be right. It's never going to happen. That will never happen.
Seriously, I welcome challenge. Too many people will stand up and go, I am an expert and what I say is the truth, the gospel. No. There's so many uncertainties and changes in life that if somebody says they're an expert, you can't know everything about everything. So I will always be ready to be, you know, for someone to challenge me. Do not assume that anything I say, you know, is fact. But when I deliver facts, I always make sure that there is a path to a checkable source so it doesn't become evangelism.
Good stuff. Always a joy.
Have a lovely weekend. There's this strange golden orb in the sky that is blinding me. You've not seen one of these this year, have you?
Not yet. apparently, Aberdeen saw sunshine for the first time in 20 days today, apparently.
Hang on, Paul, do you know what they call that in Aberdeen? Summer. Summer.
The summer's come early.
Yeah, that's it. They've had 2 days of summer. That's it. It's gone now. Love Granite City.
Indeed, a beautiful place. As you know, hey, listen, we're very blessed. But listen, Graham, as always, thank you so much. It's been a real joy and a pleasure. We have lots. We've even got another Graham Cooper podcast. So you can go back 2 years or whatever it was, 3 years, to listen to the first podcast and compare it to this one. And there's hundreds more, of course, of great, great conversations. Head over to theevcafe.org for those, or Spotify or Apple and all those good places. Of course, follow all of our socials and LinkedIn and, you know, that kind of stuff, and connect with Graham Cooper, because whenever he shares something on LinkedIn, it is worth reading and listening to. So but in the meantime, everybody, have a great day. Hopefully it's not -6 with 2 foot of snow where you are, but it is where Graham is. And I hope all of this has put a bit of warmth into your heart. Have a great day, everyone.